thank you for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, there are a few ways you can do it. And all you have to do is follow the link at the top of our show notes. You could purchase some merch, like a t-shirt or a mug, or you could purchase something from one of our affiliates, like the Health Ranger store. Health Ranger provides a competitively priced, health-related products, superfoods, storable foods, preparedness items, and more. Each time you click on their link and make a purchase, we receive a small commission. Also, you could subscribe to our Patreon page for pennies a day. We have a ton of content that's not on the podcast. The money we receive goes to better our show. Also, I know things are tough right now. If you can't afford a shirt or a Patreon subscription, you can go to iTunes and leave us a review. This will help out a ton. And as always, thank you for being part of the podcast, and we hope you enjoy it.
This particular Venusian was a remarkable Venusian. This Venusian was tall with fair skin, long blonde hair, and blue eyes. In other words, this Venusian corresponded to a T to the Nazi racial stereotype of the pure Aryan being. It's interesting, too, that this particular ET was also from Venus, the same planet which Jack Parsons' contact had also supposedly come from. By the way, the I Am cult has also evolved in its own way to the present day. The I Am cult gave rise to Elizabeth Clare Prophet's organization, originally known as the Summit Lighthouse, later and now, I believe, called the Church Universal and Triumphant. This is the group that's building underground bunkers and storing weapons up near Yellowstone National Park, a group which, properly so, has generated a lot of alarm. Now, again, Adamski was affiliated with William Dudley Pelley and the I Am cult in the pre-World War II period. This is a fellow who, after World War II, had an encounter with a, quote, Venusian with long blonde hair, fair skin, and blue eyes. It's also worth noting that in the immediate post-World War II period, we really had no idea what the planet Venus was like. Today, we know that Venus could not possibly support any life form even remotely resembling ours. Sure as hell, it would not give rise to anybody with long blonde hair and blue eyes and fair skin looking like we do. So again, I think with our advanced scientific knowledge, we can not only be skeptical of the nature of the Adamski contact, we can also begin to see it in terms of not an extraterrestrial, but an only two terrestrial phenomenon. After World War II, after William Dudley Pelley got out of prison for sedition, again plotting with Nazi Germany to overthrow the government of the United States, he was released from prison and founded a mystical organization called Soulcraft. He also published a racist/fascist magazine called Valor, and also wrote a book which was very reminiscent of the Seth writings, supposed automatic writings from a channeled being, and I'm pretty skeptical about that phenomenon as well. One of the other early contactees was a guy named George Hunt Williamson, whose real name was Michelle, or his name at birth was Michelle Dobrenovic, D'Obrenovic. Michelle Dobrenovic was affiliated with William Dudley Pelley's Soulcraft organization, was an individual who witnessed George Adamski's contact with the, quote, Venusian. Again, the long blonde hair, the blue eyes, the fair skin. And he confirmed George Adamski's account of this meeting with, quote, our brother from space, unquote, or in this case specifically from Venus. And it's interesting to me that not only that he was able to corroborate the contact, but that both individuals had had contact with William Dudley Pelley. Adamski was affiliated with the Silver Shirts and the I Am cult, and George Hunt Williamson with the Soulcraft organization, which was post-World War II. Many of the other contactees have also been affiliated with or connected through intermediaries to the Soulcraft organization of William Dudley Pelley. Two of the people that were affiliated with this were a woman named Mrs. Keach, one of the early contactees, also a fellow named Andrija Puharic, that's Andrija Puharic. You will see the name of Andrija Puharic around today. He was also part of the Soulcraft Nexus. And several of the other individuals who were affiliated with Soulcraft and William Dudley Pelley in the post-World War II period were two brothers named Rex and Ray Stanford, who are now down in Texas, and also a fellow named John McCoy, who, interestingly enough, is linking the whole UFO phenomenon with the, quote, international Jewish banking conspiracy, unquote, which goes all the way back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, to which William Dudley Pelley was introduced when he was serving with the Siberian Expeditionary Force immediately after World War I, when the U.S. and other nations were attempting to overthrow the fledgling Bolshevik regime. Something which will have a great deal of relevance for those of us here in the Silicon Valley, another of the people who is believed. There are many anecdotal accounts of his contact with the Soulcraft Nexus, although this has never been absolutely confirmed as far as I have been able to tell. Still, there are enough reliable accounts that it appears probable that he was also one of the Soulcraft, in the Soulcraft orbit, to make a slight pun, and an individual who also was known to have believed in ETs, and that is Dr. Lockheed. That's Dr. Lockheed as in Lockheed Missiles and Space, the largest employer here in the Silicon Valley. By the way, he was of Scotch origin, and if you see the name before it became the corporate logo that it is today, it's spelled L-A-U-G-H-E-A-D, like Laughhead, which, as far as I'm concerned, people who believe in ETs, not UFOs, but ETs, really are laughheads. But Dr. Lockheed was one of the people in William Dudley Pelley's orbit. Now, interestingly enough, George Adamski became one of the international emissaries traveling all around the world advocating that we prepare for contact with our brothers from space because they are here or they're coming and we should be ready to welcome them with open arms because they have so much to give us because they are superior. Now, George Adamski has claimed that the people who first motivated him to begin this international crusade were four scientists from the Point Loma Naval Electronics Laboratory. It is known that the main promoter for George Adamski's travels in Great Britain was a career British intelligence officer. One of the people who has been most instrumental in promoting Adamski in his travels in Australia was an individual who has seen Adamski's passport, and it apparently is a special diplomatic passport. He travels with special U.S. government authorized credentials. Now, again, as a political researcher, when I began seeing so many national security related organizations, such as the Navy, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, the Point Loma Naval Electronics Laboratory, somewhat remote extension, Lockheed. When I began seeing people like William Dudley Pelley and individuals associated with him, among the seminal contactees, this again led me to sniffing the air and to suspect that we were looking not only at a political phenomenon, but one which could perhaps be manipulated in such a way as to create a totalitarian form of government. I would also note in this regard that the UFO, or the ET contact, I should say, not the UFO phenomenon, is one which is in some ways a descendant of the same philosophical tradition which gave rise to Nazism in Germany. Now, Nazism, to make a very long story very short, and perhaps telescope a bit, again, a bit of a pun here, the Nazi Party itself grew out of an occult organization called the Thule Society, or perhaps it's Thule. I've never heard it pronounced. I've heard it pronounced by British commentators as the Thule Society. This was an occult society which was of the belief that the German race, the Aryan race, again with blonde hair, blue eyes, and fair skin, was descended from the residents of a mystical island called Thule, which was a land of ice, and that they were inherently superior to the rest of us, and that the Aryan race was destined to rule the earth. This philosophy grew out of a number of occult philosophies which grew to strength in the 19th and early 20th centuries. They are also descended from a school of philosophy known as Ariosophy, which basically, this is a very dangerous philosophical outlook. Ariosophy maintains that we as humans were at one time a much more advanced, much more ennobled race or species than we are, but that over a period of time we allowed ourselves to fall either through moral corruption or through inbreeding with inferior beings. The notion of Atlantis is an example of the Ariosophist philosophy. The notion was that Atlantis was a superior society, that they were technologically far in advance of even what we've been able to achieve today, but that they allowed themselves to become corrupt, and their karma came true, so to speak. Their dogma got run over by their karma, and they ultimately fell due to their own misdeeds. Ariosophy is essentially the school of philosophy from which the racial views of the Nazi Party in Germany grew. The notion was that the Aryans, again, blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, rather like Adamski's, quote, Venusian, unquote, the notion was that the Aryans were superior, but that through allowing inferior races to marry with them and to gain control in their society, they ultimately fell. And it is a very, very dangerous philosophy. It is one which many of the many of the UFO cults are affiliated. And again, I note the similarity between the, quote, Venusians, unquote, cited by people like Adamski and George Hunt Williamson, and again, bear in mind the explicit Nazi affiliations of the Silver Shirts and the IM cult. That also, again, led me to sniffing the air. One of the things that's interesting, too, is the symbolism used by many of the UFO cults. Many of the UFO cults use symbols which are readily recognizable to those of us here on terra firma. There is a guy who's making the rounds right now named Claude Vorillon. It's a Frenchman, last name V-O-R. Is it I-L-L-H-O-N or H-I-L-L-O-N? I've forgotten offhand. But anyway, Claude Vorillon claims to have met a quote E.T. unquote named Rael, R-A-E-L, who advised him to spread the word that our brothers from space, again in quotes, were going to be visiting us and that they would come down and they would right all wrongs and that Earth would become a paradise and that we should simply abolish all systems of government and turn the governing of the Earth over to, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. In fact, within the past several months, Claude Vorillon was featured in some articles in the San Jose Mercury News. He also received some publicity concerning an appearance he made at the UN, or an appeal he made to the United Nations, to establish a special embassy for preparing us to have contact with visitors from outer space. Now, interestingly, this Rael, this small cherubic being that Claude Vorillon met and who influenced Claude Vorillon to become converted to the belief in the, quote, brothers from space, unquote, gave him a symbol, which has become the symbol that Claude Vorillon traffics around. He wears a pendant around his neck with the symbol. It's the Star of David with a swastika inside, which, again, does not sound anything like anything we would expect from another planet any more than we would expect a Venusian to look like Reinhard Heydrich. But once again, we are told that our brothers from space are going to be visiting us and that the proof of this, their symbol is the Star of David inside of a swastika. Now, the reason why I went into the notion of Ariosophy is because another common belief of many of the UFO cults is that all of our technology is descended from visitations that we had in the past by ETs, that ETs visited us, our brothers from space visited us in the distant past, and they gave us all of our technology. They helped us to build the Egyptians to build the pyramids and so forth. That is dangerous from a number of different standpoints. In the first place, there is the notion that human beings are not capable of making great achievements on their own, and they most assuredly are. It, in effect, could be used, and I think at least to a certain extent has been used, as a vehicle for psychological warfare to convince us that, well, gosh, folks, you know, everything we have comes from these visitations by beings from on high. It destroys belief in the competence of humanity. The less one believes in the ability of human beings to govern their own affairs, the more likely one is to turn the governance of those affairs over to someone or something else, including and especially, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. Beyond that, and Vallée goes into this in excellent fashion, it's a very small step to, step in belief from the notion that we were visited by ETs from thousands of years ago and they gave us all of our technology, to the notion that perhaps the ETs had, quote, known the daughters of man, unquote, and had, quote, found them fair, unquote. In other words, basically that some of us have the blood of star people in our veins and that we are therefore superior. We're descended from superior beings and that the rest of us have the blood of just lowly earth beings in our veins, and we are therefore inferior and not as good as those of us who are of extraterrestrial breeding, unquote. Well, again, when you have people like Claude Vorillon going around claiming to have been visited by extraterrestrials And the symbol given to him by the extraterrestrials is a Star of David and a swastika. When you have George Adamski and George Hunt Williamson and individuals associated with an explicitly Nazi organization, when you have people like Dr. Lockheed, when you have people associated with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the Aerojet Corporation and the Point Loma Naval Electronics Laboratory, when these organizations and these individuals figure into the seminal contacts with, quote, ETs, and again, I'm not talking about sightings of UFOs, but when these individuals figure prominently in the generation of the ET myth, I think this is something we have to be very much on guard, concerned. Well, I think we have to be on our guard, because when we see the, quote, Venusian, unquote, fitting the Aryan racial stereotype advocated by Adolf Hitler, and when we see the similarity between the viewpoints of the UFO cults, many of which are based on what is essentially an Ariosophist viewpoint, and the philosophical tributaries which gave rise to Nazism, this is something we have to be on our guard for. Hitler, at least for the time being, failed, but we are in a position, I think, to be seduced by an essentially fascist philosophy if we allow ourselves to believe in, quote, ETs, unquote, and, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. And in particular, if we become convinced that every great achievement of humanity is only by virtue of our having been visited by, quote, our brothers from space, unquote. It's also interesting to me, this is not discussed in any of the ET books or any of the UFO books, but in some dozen I've read, I've never seen an account of a female ET. You know, one has to assume, therefore, that either they are hermaphroditic or they have some other means of reproduction, but you never hear about a female ET. I've seen all kinds of accounts of ETs. I never saw one with breasts, even though this account of the Venusian in the desert had long blonde hair and blue eyes and fair skin. Again, just something that I would note in passing. Another thing that's interesting concerning the Ariosophist aspects of the ET, quote, UFO cult phenomenon is that many of you may be familiar with the book The Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken, one of the early advocates that, in fact, we had been visited by ETs a long time ago, and that this accounts for so many sightings in the Bible, like Ezekiel's wheel, and they built the pyramids and all this sort of thing. Interestingly enough, Eric von Daniken was very much taken with the philosophy of a guy named Hans Horbiger. That's the last name is H-O-R-B-I-G-E-R. Horbiger was one of the individuals whose occult philosophy contributed in a significant way to the origins of Nazism and to the Thule Society's philosophical outlook. Horbiger had what he considered to be a mystical experience in which a piece of molten metal fell into a piece of ice. It then sank through the ice, the steam built up, and there was an explosion. From this particular experience, Hans Horbiger had what he considered to be a cosmic awareness, a cosmic burst of awareness, and he felt that everything in the universe was created as a result of an interplay between fire and ice. Hans Horbiger had a very profound impact on the philosophy of Adolf Hitler. It also had a very, that is to say, Hans Horbiger had a very profound effect upon the intellect of Eric von Daniken as well. If you read about some of the occult connections to Nazism and some of the philosophical tributaries from which Nazism evolved, and again, I'm not talking about Nazism as a political phenomenon, but as an intellectual and philosophical phenomenon, you will inevitably come across the philosophy of Hans Horbiger. And again, I note that one of the early advocates of the chariots, of the notion we were visited from ETs a long time ago, and that's where our civilization evolved from, that was Eric von Daniken, and he was also very much taken with Hans Horbiger. Another thing I noted, too, and this is another thing that led me to become politically suspicious of the notion of ETs, not of the concept of UFOs, but the notion that they came from outer space, the head of Project Blue Book, the Air Force's ostensible investigation of the UFO phenomenon, was a fellow named Major Donald Keough, last name K-E-Y-H-O-E. Donald Keough was the very first person to publicly say that flying saucers are real. You know, they're not thermal inversions, it's not the planet Venus on a bright night or whatever. He said they were real, although he never said for sure whether they were from outer space or not. He hinted that they were. I noted, and this may be peripheral, but I noted that in his biographical notes, Donald Keough had at one point been an aide to Charles Lindbergh. That's the lone eagle who flew the Spirit of St. Louis to Paris. One thing that is not well known about Charles Lindbergh is that after his well-publicized experiences as an aviator, he later became a Germanophile, and specifically he was not only taken with the Third Reich's aviation achievements, but he also became a very active member of an organization called America First. Now, America First was an isolationist organization, many of whose members were sincerely isolationist. They simply wanted to keep the U.S. out of World War II to spare American boys the slaughter in combat. But many of them were also doctrinaire fascists who sought to keep America out of World War II so Germany would win. The Third Reich's intelligence apparatus in the United States actively funded America First. Even though some of them were sincere isolationists, many of them were doctrinaire fascists. Both, for obvious reasons, served the purposes of the Third Reich in that they would they were operating to keep the U.S. out of World War II. Obviously, that served the interests of Nazi Germany. And again, when I saw that Keo had been connected with Lindbergh, I don't know to what extent they may have had contact after the period in which he was attached to Lindbergh as an aide. But it again led me to ask some questions. I do not have answers to those questions, and I want to emphasize that this particular connection may be peripheral. Also, and this again may be completely irrelevant, and I want to emphasize that, I noted that the very first contact in the United States with flying saucers, the first credible sighting of flying saucers, not the first contact with ETs, which actually, oddly enough, the contact that Jack Parsons had with the Venusian he met in the desert, that happened before anybody had seen flying saucers. But in 1947, a fellow named Ken Arnold, who was on a fishing trip in the Pacific Northwest, sighted a formation of UFOs over the lake in which he was fishing. Ken Arnold was the grandson of a close affiliate of Burton Wheeler, Senator Burton Wheeler from Montana. Now, I certainly would not want to make too much of the fact that he was a grandson of someone close to Burton Wheeler, but Burton Wheeler was also an active member of America First. Actually, he may have been a congressman, not a senator, I'm not sure which, but whichever he was, Burton Wheeler was one of the pro-fascist members of America First, and in fact, he actually had Third Reich propaganda mailed out throughout the United States free of charge using his congressional franking privileges, because he also was in contact with some of the same Third Reich diplomats / intelligencers who had helped to fund and channel propaganda to William Dudley Pelley. And again, that may be completely irrelevant, but it is interesting that the very first flying saucer encounter was Ken Arnold's, a descendant of the openly pro-fascist representative or senator, I'm not sure which, Burton Wheeler, affiliated with America First like Charles Lindbergh, Donald Keough, an aide to Charles Lindbergh. Now, these last two connections may be completely irrelevant, but on the other hand, they may be relevant, too. I mention them because as I began to study the seminal contacts with, quote, ETs, unquote, and some of the first sightings of, quote, UFOs, unquote, I began seeing evidentiary tributaries running in the direction or directly involving many of the things which, as a political researcher, I was directly familiar with. And that made me incredibly suspicious of the notion that we were ever visited by people from other planets. We know damn well that there is no other planet in our solar system capable of supporting life, anything remote, a life form even remotely resembling ours, much less Venus, which is incredibly toxic. And if there's any kind of living being from Venus, it sure as hell, again, is not going to have blonde hair, blue eyes, and fair skin. The nearest solar system to ours is, I don't know how many light years away, 4.5 or 3.5, but even one light year is one hell of a distance. A light year, of course, is the distance that that light travels in a year. It's an enormous distance. And the notion that there would be a civilization, the universe had evolved at a particular time, the notion that a civilization would be so far in advance of ours technologically that they could overcome the enormous distances that it would be involved is, to me, incredible. The basic principle involved in interstellar travel would have to involve some sort of transporter beam or something which would basically establish travel at the speed of light or something approximating it. And it is impossible for me to imagine or to conceive, and I know a little bit about physics, and I'm not a theoretical physicist, but that a huge flying machine could be made to disassemble molecularly and then be projected through space at the speed of light. But the nearest solar system is several light years away, and we know damn well that no other life form could no other planet in our solar system, I should say, could possibly support a life form in any way resembling ours. It's also interesting that all of the contacts with ETs involve beings which are essentially humanoid. In other words, they're not giant globs of protoplasm with tentacles and two eyes coming out of them. They're all roughly humanoid, not just the obvious Aryan Venusian that Adamski and George Hunt Williamson saw. They're all basically humanoid. There's no reason to suppose that a life form that would evolve on another planet, whether in our solar system or any place else, would in any way resemble ours. I thought maybe we'd take a break at this point, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to discuss not only the hard historical record concerning the development of circular flying machines in our atmosphere, but by human beings, by the way, not, quote, Venusians, unquote, but I'm also going to discuss some of the questions that I have concerning ways in which the ET phenomenon could be manifested using technology. Now, what I'm going to talk about in this part of the lecture is the actual technology or some of the technologies that may be involved in some of the things that we're looking at. Now, with regard to ETs themselves, and obviously I am skeptical that we have been visited by beings from another planet, there's no firm evidence that I have ever seen that would indicate there's intelligent life on other planets. There's damn little evidence of intelligent life on this one if you take a look around. I'm afraid, however, I'm convinced that UFOs are real. There have been too many pilots and too many radar sightings to be dismissed, where I'm going to go into the development of UFOs. However, I think that with our deteriorating economic conditions, with our deteriorating environment, with a deteriorating educational system, and as I said, with a growing belief in what I would consider to be irrational religion. And there's much of religion which can be linked very closely with philosophy or even higher mathematics, but with people in so many different parts of the world ready to simply retreat to what I would consider to be an earlier stage of human development, a belief in irrationalism, I think we have to be on our guard for, quote, the man behind the curtain, unquote. Now, one of the things that may very well figure into the ET phenomenon is mind control. In Radio Free America shows 5, 6, and 7, and a number of miscellaneous archive shows, I have gone into mind control technology. By the way, on your way out, or after the lecture, Paul from Archives on Audio has a desk set up there. He has many of the archive shows, and you can either order programs from him or purchase them directly from the stock that he has on hand. But one of the things that may very well account for some of the ET contacts is mind control. Many of the people that have described experiences with ETs have done so after being hypnotically regressed. And there are so many possibilities for mind control having been used on these people that one thing that we have to be alert for is the possibility of mind control. If a person is subjected to mind control, and there are many techniques that can be used, combinations of hypnosis, psychosurgery, classical and operant conditioning, the use of psychopharmacological drugs, generally these things are used in combination with each other. You can make a person under mind control believe in anything. They'll believe in little green men or gray men or whatever. Mind control is one of the things, physical mind control, I should say, the actual interference with the intellect, with the consciousness of an individual human being, is something that I think we have to be on alert for. Another thing which could very well be used or perhaps has already been used concerns the use of holograms or holographic projections. These, as I'm sure many of you know, are three-dimensional projections. It's like a television image, except it's three-dimensional and would appear to an observer to be an actual three-dimensional entity. I'm going to read a short article from the San Francisco Examiner. Now, I can't say whether this has been used or may be used in the future, but it's something we have to consider. By the way, one thing that I should emphasize is that one of the main factors of having just lived through the Cold War is that we have been living through a period of accelerated technological development, much of it secret. And this period of accelerated technological development has spanned almost half a century. One of the rules of thumb in examining the national security establishment, and that's one of my areas of expertise, is that much of the technological development has been accomplished secretly. Reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, February 21st of this year, in the Down to a Science column by a woman named Kay Davidson, K-E-A-Y is her first name, there's a short article here which is entitled Army Plans Propaganda in the Sky. And she begins her paragraph, Lie in the Sky. Holograms may be used in psychological warfare. Army experts foresee devices that project, quote, persuasive messages and three-dimensional pictures on clouds, smoke, rain, droplets, buildings, etc., to target civilian and or military audiences, unquote, the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and school in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, reports. Well, again, if this is projected for the future, it's quite possible that such technologies are either under an advanced state of research and development now or have already been developed and not yet employed tactically, at least in, quote, combat, unquote. The possibility of holographic projection is one of the things that I think we have to be on the alert for in terms of seeing little green men or gray men or whatever. Another possibility, and this will sound very weird to people perhaps, but we are now living in the age of genetic engineering. As early as 1962, the Pentagon had 40 geneticists employed full-time, and we don't really know how far the military may have proceeded with genetic engineering, but it is a rule of thumb that our national security establishment gets any technology before the civilian sector and generally advances it to a state of development far in advance. They advance it far beyond what the civilian sector is aware of. There was an article in the New York Times in 1985 which made me sit up and take note. There was an experiment performed in which a gene from a firefly was projected into it, was inserted, I should say, into a tobacco plant. And the results, and pictures of this were shown in the New York Times and other major dailies, the result was a tobacco leaf that glowed like a firefly. Now, the implications of this are enormous. We're taking a gene from an insect, inserting it into a plant, and it produces the same physical characteristic in the plant that it produced in the insect. The implications of this, as I said, are enormous. Another thing that has come under discussion, and in fact there was a ferocious debate engaged in between the scientific community and the Vatican, it has been considered a viable technology for the not-too-distant future to take genes from humans, from Homo sapiens, and to insert them into higher primates and to develop what in essence would be a new species which could perform certain crude labor, and yet they would not technically be human beings. This raises a lot of ethical questions. Would they have human rights? This has been looked to by industrialists and financiers as a way of perhaps developing a viable labor force for doing crude labor, yet because they would not actually be human beings, they would not have, quote, human rights, unquote. So therefore, if you work them to death or whatever, that would be perfectly okay. It would be rather like animal experimentation. The Vatican expressed moral revulsion at this. But this was something that was discussed a number of years ago, and it had been contemplated and seen as viable by genetic engineers a number of years ago. One of the things that we either may be looking at now or may be encountering at some point in the future are genetically engineered, translated genetically mutated, human beings. If a gene from a firefly can be inserted into a tobacco plant, and then the tobacco plant manifests the same physical characteristic that that gene produced in the tobacco plant, or the firefly, I should say, at some point, we may be seeing human beings with a gene from, say, perhaps a frog or a salamander inserted into them, and this might produce something with the basic physical characteristics of a human being, but perhaps with smooth green skin and vertical eye, or yellow eyes with vertical slits. Now, obviously, this is rumination, but at some point in the future, and perhaps we may be closer to this than we are now, we may be seeing something like this. So another thing that I think we have to be on the alert for as citizens is the possibility of genetic engineering being used to produce, quote, ETs, unquote, at some point in the future. Now, this is rumination and obviously should be viewed as such. I personally am convinced that at some point, with the deterioration of the environment, the deterioration of the economy, and again with the growth in what I consider to be irrationalist fundamental religions, we are going to see a manifestation of visitors from outer space, and this, quote, visitors from outer space, unquote, and the potential for social control would be enormous. Now, something with which most people are familiar is the very famous War of the Worlds broadcast that Orson Welles had in, I think it was 1938, maybe 39. In any event, this was a radio play based on H.G. Wells' science fiction novel about the War of the Worlds, an invasion of the United States by Martians, real Martians from Mars. And this was broadcast on Halloween, either I think it was 38, might have been 1939. And even though the sponsors were interrupting the radio play at various points to make it clear that this was a radio play, that this was not a real newscast, it was done as though this were a newscast, a real broadcast. And even though there were no flying saucers, no flying machines, no death rays, people panicked. People were ready to commit suicide. They made out their wills. There was mass hysteria. And this, again, as a result of a radio play. Now, if we were at some point to bring down real UFOs with perhaps holographic projections or genetically engineered people or beings to look like something from another planet, or perhaps people dressed up in suits like you would see at a science fiction movie, the potential for producing mass hysteria or mass belief in visitation of ETs from another planet is enormous, and I think we have to be on guard for that. Mind control, holographic projection, and genetic engineering are three of the things that I think we have to be on the alert for in terms of ETs. Now, something which is far better documented than that concerns the development of circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere. And what I'm going to talk about next concerns the actual historical record of circular flying machines that are known to have flown in Earth's atmosphere, not built by our brothers from space, but built by human beings. Now, again, I refer people to the book Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, again, a fellow who was in charge of research and development for the Italian Air Force, also a veteran Italian intelligencer. He goes into the historical record of some of the experiments that German aviation was engaging in during the World War II and some of the technological developments that they had achieved during the closing months of the Second World War. Any competent history of the activities of the Army, the U.S. Army, U.S. 8th Army Air Force during the closing months of World War II will go into what is known as the Foo Fighters or Krautballs. Foo, by the way, is a corruption of the French word for feu, fire, F-E-U. It was corrupted by American airmen to be foo, F-O-O. A number of American planes, both bombers and interceptors, saw glowing circular objects which caused their electronics and in particular their radar to malfunction as they were on missions over Germany during the closing months of World War II. What they were witnessing, and I'm going to go into the actual development of these, was the use of a German anti-aircraft device known as the Feuerball or Fireball. Now, first I'm going to begin with a discussion by reading from Vesco's text of the so-called Krautballs or Foo Fighters. Vesco writes in Intercept But Don't Shoot, "A former flying officer who had been in the intelligence section of the 8th Air Force during the final days of the war in Europe and did not wish to be named, apparently because he was still working in some section of the U.S. Air Force, declared to the New York Press, quote, 'It is quite possible that the flying saucers are the latest development of a, quote, psychological, unquote, anti-aircraft weapon that the Germans had already used. During night missions over western Germany, I happened to see on several occasions shining discs or balls that followed our formations. It was well known that the German night fighters had powerful headlights in their noses or propeller hubs, lights that would suddenly catch the target, partly in order to give the German pilots better aim, but mostly in order to blind the enemy tail gunners in their turrets. They caused frequent alarms and continual nervous tension among the crews, thereby lowering their efficiency. During the last year of the war, the Germans also sent up a number of radio-controlled bright objects to interfere with the ignition systems of our engines or the operation of the onboard radar. In all probability, American scientists picked up this invention and are now perfecting it so that it will be on a par with the new offensive and defensive air weapons," unquote. Again, that's a quote from a former intelligence officer working with the 8th Army Air Force. Vesco continues, "Then other flyers who had taken part in the opening of the Second Front also reported to the press that toward the end of the hostilities in the area between Hagenau and Alsace-Lorraine and Neustadt on der Weinstraße in the Rhine Valley, there were certain phenomena that oddly resembled the present-day reports of flying saucers. Convinced that they were faced with a new German secret weapon, the American flyers called them Foo Fighters, firefighters from the French feu, or fire, and jokingly, quote, krautballs, unquote. Subsequently, something similar but on a far smaller scale was seen by bomber crews over the Japanese islands. Former war correspondent R. Palmer, for example, has related how one of the Foo Fighters followed an American plane over the Rhine Valley for about 18 miles. The incident began at about 10 p.m. on November 23, 1944. Lieutenant Edward Schluter, S-C-H-L-U-E-T-E-R, of the 415th U.S. Night Fighter Squadron stationed at Dijon, was flying a heavy night fighter toward Mainz. After carrying out a large-scale diversion along the northern edge of the Black Forest, the pilot began to follow the long ribbon of the Rhine. At about 20 miles from Strasbourg, Lieutenant Fred Ringwald, an Air Force intelligence officer who was taking part in the mission as an observer, glanced out the side window of the darkened cockpit and saw in the distance about 10 small balls of reddish fire flying in formation at an amazing speed. Quote, I wonder what those lights are over in the hills, Ringwald said to Schluter. Probably stars, the pilot replied. I don't think so. Are you sure they're not a reflection from us? Positive. Puzzled, the pilot looked hard at the lights, which were now coming straight toward his plane. Without further delay, he radioed the American ground radar station, quote, there are about 10 Heine night fighters around here in the sky. Looks as if they are chasing us and their speed is high, quote, you guys must be nuts. Nobody up there but yourself, replied the radar station. Now notice the radar does not detect these. Vesco has an explanation for that, which will come up in the next section I'm going to read, not the next section of the book that I'm going to extract here. Continuing, the radar observer, Lieutenant Donald J. Myers, then got on the plane's radar scope to scan the fiery balls, but although the danger zone and the entire sky in the vicinity was scanned, there was no evidence of enemy aircraft. Quote, sure, no enemy planes showed up on the screen, and yet those red lights, unquote. They continued to glow in sinister fashion a few miles off. Schluter moved toward them at full throttle. As if they had foreseen the attack, the glow of the bodies rapidly dimmed, and without changing position, after a few moments, they became completely invisible. The American plane crossed that part of the sky without encountering any moving body. More than 2 minutes went by, and the globes, glowing red as before, reappeared but somewhat farther off as though regrouping for a counterattack. Instead, 6 minutes later, after having completed a very long glide, they vanished into the night toward the German rear behind the Siegfried Line. At this point, the plane's radar began to give evidence of serious malfunctioning, and the pilot had to give up his train strafing for the night. Discussing what had happened during the flight back to the base, the flyers came to the conclusion that what they had seen were experimental devices which explained the malfunctioning of the radar on the order of the small, multicolored rockets that earlier used to be fired at German anti-aircraft batteries in order to confuse their aim during the Great Night bombing raids. Since they had not been able to identify the lights with any degree of certainty, and since the lights themselves had given no indication of aggressive intention, the flyers decided not to mention them in their flight report to the Dijon command for fear of being considered lunatics or victims of war neurosis. Now, I would note here a couple of the things which are similar to the behaviors of the, quote, UFOs which were seen over Washington. When it became apparent that they were being detected and going to be intercepted, they danced away. Note also that the flyers were hesitant to report this because they were afraid of being perceived as nuts. That's very similar to the way Jacques Vallée's compatriots reacted when they saw the UFO through the powerful telescope at the observatory. Only Vallée of the 8 observers was willing to talk about it. The others were afraid that they would be professionally damaged by being perceived as nuts. Now, what Vallée goes into next concerns the actual development of the feuerball or fireball. Not Vallée, excuse me, Vesco. In a section that he entitles appropriately the anti-radar feuerball, Vesco, again formerly in charge of research and development for the Italian Air Force, goes into the actual technological development of these. And again, one of the things that I think is excellent about this book is that it is both very readable and yet also very technologically competent. I had a tough time going through it the first time around, not being an aeronautical engineer or versed in applied or theoretical physics. I had to read many of the footnotes, some of them 2 paragraphs in length, several times before I was able to understand them. Now, in the section, the anti-radar feuerball, now again, we're talking about documented history of things that were created by human beings, not people from another planet, during the closing months of the Second World War.